Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited. I'm your host, Maggie Creech, and today we're going back in time to uncover the true origins of the American Revolution. Believe it or not, the story began decades before the Boston Tea Party or the Continental Congress in a conflict that spanned continents and involved not just Britain and France, but also indigenous nations. Today, we're talking about the French and Indian War, a war that you've probably heard about in passing, but might not fully understand in terms of its broader historical context. The truth is, this war was the event that sparked the chain reaction that led to America's Declaration of Independence. At its core, the French and Indian War was about two major European powers, Britain and France, fighting for control of North America. But there's more to the story. It's also about the indigenous nations that were caught in the middle with their own interests, alliances, and strategies. We're going to unpack how all of this connects from the first shot fired in the wilderness to the global conflict that followed. To help us understand, we'll hear from two experts, Travis Henline, curator of indigenous history and culture at the Jamestown Yorktown Foundation, and Michael Plum, vice president of guest engagement here at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Before we dive into the full story, let's start with some basics about the French and Indian War so that we're all on the same page. First, let's talk about the name. The French and Indian War sounds like it would be a conflict between the French and indigenous people, but it's actually the name that the British gave to the conflict because they were fighting the French and the French's indigenous allies. But honestly, even that's a little bit confusing because the British had indigenous allies too. This French and Indian War that begins in 1754 in North America ultimately escalates into a global war known as the Seven Years' War. Here's Michael with more.
So the French and Indian War is basically the name for the conflict between France and Britain that happened in North America, kind of very specific to the North American continent. It starts in 1754. The Seven Years' War starts in 1756 and lasts until 1763. But that is more the global war that involves all those different powers around the world, including Spain and others.
So the name confusion continues. If you count both the North American and global theaters of the war, the Seven Years' War is really 9 years. It just depends on how you do the math. Names aside, what is important to note here is that when we talk about the French and Indian War, we're really talking about one piece of a much bigger puzzle. In Europe, France and Britain had been rivals for centuries, and when it came to North America, things got heated. Here's Travis.
Conflict between the French and the British is a tale as old as time, right? So Anglo-Franco conflict goes back centuries, except this time the stakes are high. And the prize is these vast territories in North America. And so the competition really ratchets up in the 1750s, and things start to come to a head between the French interests, the British interests, and that will spill out into what will become a worldwide conflict.
Now, let's get into it. To set our scene, it's the early 1750s. Great Britain, who we know by the 13 original colonies, and France in present-day Canada and down into the Mississippi River region, are two of the most dominant European powers in North America. Across their colonial territories, European nations are all vying for the same things. Essentially, they're trying to get more land, more money, and more materials to support the mother country. However, how they approach this does vary. It depends on the country. The French were primarily after furs and faith. They wanted to dominate the fur trade and convert indigenous people to Catholicism. Meanwhile, the British were focused on amassing large tracts of land, especially land in the Ohio River Valley, a region that both sides wanted to control.
So when we look at the French, we often say this alliteration, furs and faith, meaning that the fur trade economy is a huge business. I don't think people understand how big of a business and how lucrative this trade was in beaver pelts, in deer skins, and other fur-bearing animals. But this was a huge motivation for the French. It was a commercial interest. So that was one of the big things. The faith part of it is to proselytize and to convert native people. So the Jesuit Society of Jesus, among the French in particular, are sending missionaries out among the indigenous peoples in an attempt to convert them to the Catholic faith. So furs and faith, that's the French motivation. But for the English, you know, they want land, right? This is all about land. And so that's the main name of the game for them, which is going to bring them into direct conflict with the French, because, you know, the French are making movements and leading up to the 1750s that Britain and her American colonies can begin to see, if they don't do anything about it, if they didn't do anything about it, would cut them off from access to Western lands and expansion, which is really what they want.
You might be wondering, what was so special about the Ohio River Valley? Why was it the piece of real estate in North America? And honestly, where even is it? Loosely defined, it includes a good portion of Ohio, Indiana, Kentucky, the extreme southwestern parts of Pennsylvania, extreme northwestern parts of West Virginia, and down to the junction of the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. So it's a lot of land. And never mind the fact that this entire area was already occupied by native tribes, neither the French or the British were concerned about pushing indigenous peoples out of the way to get what they wanted. Whoever controlled the Ohio River Valley controlled access to the Ohio River, the Mississippi River, and by extension, the entire western frontier. For the British, who were eyeing expansion into the West, it was critical to secure that area.
In the 1750s, the French are making moves to combine their territories. So the French are in New France, which is now Canada, Quebec and Canada. That is considered New France. The other French territory is Louisiana. Well, what can connect these two disparate areas of French territory? Well, that's, you know, the Mississippi River, the Ohio, the Mississippi. And so to link their two territories and to begin to control access to the West and make territorial claims in the West in North America, the French in the 1750s began to build a series of forts down the Allegheny River. There's like Fort Venango, Fort LeBeouf, and then eventually they end up at the Forks of the Ohio, which is present-day Pittsburgh, and they build Fort Duquesne. Well, now Virginia, they're very aware of the French movements out there. They're very concerned about them.
Well, that is a pickle if you're the Virginia colony, isn't it? If the French are able to build forts all the way down the Mississippi to connect their Canada territory all the way up north to Louisiana all the way down south, they're effectively going to block the English from expanding westward in any direction. And if you're mainly in it for the land, like the English were, then that's definitely not okay. The British were not going to back down without a fight. So now we know what the colonies want and where their sights are set. But how does this armed conflict actually take off? Here's where it gets interesting, and here's where Virginia comes into the story. Let's introduce a very famous 20-something Virginian. It's time to talk about George Washington. So when we think about George Washington, what are some words that come to mind? Tall, white-haired, president, leader? All of those things are true about a George Washington later in his life. But in 1753, a young George Washington is redheaded, both in terms of his physical appearance and his temperament. He is brash, he is impulsive, he is in his early 20s, and he is looking to make a name for himself.
So Washington, I find, is a fascinating individual. And I think I like this era in particular with regard to his own personal history, because it does help humanize him in a lot of ways. We think of Washington as sort of carved in stone on Mount Rushmore or this hero of the Revolution, but he is a young guy when a lot of this stuff is happening during this period. And we're talking in his 20s when some of these first conflicts are starting to happen. And he acts like it. He doesn't act like the seasoned old veteran that we see in the Revolutionary War. He acts like a young kid. He is vain. He is certainly seeking out advancement in his career. He wants more money. He is not happy when he doesn't get what he wants, but that really helps us understand him, I think, in a meaningful way. Washington comes from a family that didn't have tremendous means, but is sort of prominent in Virginia in the Tidewater area. He's born in 1732. His father passes away when he is 11 years old, and he is the eldest son from his father's second marriage. So he has half brothers who are older than he is and who stand to inherit more. And Washington's always kind of thinking about, how does he make his way in Virginia society of the 18th century? Well, that means land and that means money. And he's going to do whatever he can in many ways to acquire more land to increase his social prominence.
Wanting to acquire more land to build his personal wealth is a big part of Washington's choosing to be a land surveyor. This puts him at the center of Virginia's land speculation boom. Speculation was a key strategy for Virginia elites to gain wealth, with groups like the Ohio Company, co-founded by Washington's brother Lawrence, securing massive tracts of land in the Ohio Valley for future settlement and profit. Although he was a surveyor, one of Washington's biggest ambitions was to be in the military like his half-brothers. He really sort of sees the military as a means to an end. And so in 1753, when tensions are boiling in the borderlands of the Virginia colony, a young and inexperienced George Washington sees an opportunity to carve out a space for himself.
So when Governor Dinwiddie decides the French are starting to encroach on Virginia's territory, and more specifically, territory that Virginia wants to expand into, Dinwiddie decides he's got to send them a message. And that means he has to send someone to the Ohio country to deliver that message. Washington sort of puts himself forward as that messenger. He does not speak French. Might be important when you're a delegation going to deliver this message to the French. But he does have experience in the wilderness with his time as a surveyor. He feels like he's the one for the job, makes the case.
So what's crazy about this is that George Washington doesn't speak French, despite being sent on an expedition to interact with the French. He has no military experience. And despite this, Dinwiddie actually picks him. So Washington is this inexperienced, eager 21-year-old major in the Virginia Regiment, and he sets off on this journey to the forks of the Ohio, up the Allegheny River to French forts that are being built in that area to tell them to get out. There are a few guys with him who help make this possible: Jacob von Braun, who does speak French, and Christopher Gist, a trader who knows the area, as well as four leaders of indigenous tribes from the area. A very influential Seneca leader named Tenacrosen, also known as Half King, is chosen to speak for the groups of indigenous people that lived in the Ohio country, which included the Delaware, the Shawnee, and the Mingo. Tenacrosen gets to the region in the late 1740s, and in 1753, about the same time that Washington is about to make his journey into the Ohio country, Tenacrosen had sent messages to the French telling them to get the heck out of his land, his country. And so when Washington arrived, he found an unlikely ally in Tenacrosen, because they both had the goal of getting the French to leave. And so Tenacrosen joins him on this journey, which is interesting because we must imagine that Tenacrosen would also have not wanted the British in his country. But for now, they're united against a common enemy. After weeks of rough travel through the Appalachian wilderness, they arrive, they are received peacefully by the French, and Washington is able to deliver this ultimatum in the form of a letter from Governor Dinwiddie. It essentially says, get out or there will be problems. Now, Washington has military with him, but this is meant to be a diplomatic mission. And so the French read this, they laugh, they say thanks, but no thanks. We are staying and our claims out here are indisputable. Washington can't really do much about this. And so he takes the word back to Governor Dinwiddie in Williamsburg. This also doesn't sit very well with the colonial governor, and so he sends Washington back out again, only this time things look a little different.
Once Dinwiddie receives this French response, he decides to start mobilizing Virginia's forces to go and take that territory. So he authorizes raising the Virginia Regiment, which would be a regiment of soldiers who are paid. This is not militia. They're going to be paid and outfitted and trained and sent out to take over that territory for the crown. When that happens, there's a colonel who's appointed for the regiment, and Washington is appointed as the lieutenant colonel, so the kind of second in command. He starts raising troops and starts to make his way out to western Pennsylvania, or what's now western Pennsylvania.
All right, so now things are getting real. Both sides seem ready for a fight. George Washington will soon find himself in the right place at the right time. Or maybe it's the wrong place at the wrong time.
Open now at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, Unbound, Free Black Virginians, an exhibition tracing the lives of free Black Virginians from 1619 to the end of slavery in 1865. Discover how these individuals claimed their freedom, built thriving communities, and navigated a society that called them free but not equal. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org.
So Washington takes his Virginia militia. They go back. They're encamped at a place near what is a place called the Great Meadow, which is in the present-day Laurel Highlands of Pennsylvania. And one evening, a group of Seneca show up in Washington's camp. They are led by a Seneca headman known as Tenacrisson, otherwise known as the Half-King. And so Tenacrisson shows up and informs Washington that there is a party of French soldiers not far from his position. They're just up on a ridge not far from where the Virginians are encamped. And he suggests to Washington that they should go check it out. And so they march all night in a pouring rain, losing their way a few times. Eventually, they find their way to the top of the ridge around dawn, and the French are just waking up. They're encamped in a gully, a rock face that's kind of like a little valley. And above them, surrounding them, are Washington and the Virginia militia and Tenacrisson and his Seneca warriors. Now, here's where things get interesting, because the French will later say that the British fired first. The British will say that the French fired first. I have often wondered if it wasn't one of the Seneca that fired first. So Tenacrisson, as it turns out, he has a vested interest in picking this fight, right? And so whoever fired first, there's a skirmish.
So it's not 100% clear what happens, but what we do know is that there's a 15-minute skirmish that the French lose. They're forced to surrender. Their commander, Ensign Joseph Coulon de Villiers de Jumonville, is killed. And it's a little bit unclear as to how exactly this happens. But the French basically say, because there was a French survivor who escapes, that the Virginians just opened fire on them without any warning. Washington says that one of the Frenchmen saw his troops coming and they opened fire on them. We do know that Washington's men fired two volleys into the French camp. Here's where different perspectives really complicate this story. The French claim they were on a diplomatic mission, not unlike the one that Washington went on the year before. You remember the one where he was graciously received by the French? Well, Washington and Tenacrisson aren't so sure. They feel like the French force was intentionally trying to disguise their motions and their intent. They think, well, if they were supposed to do that, why wouldn't they have just come and talked to us? Why were they hiding out a short distance from our camp? And so Washington knows that there's likely to be a French response to this encounter. And so him and his men fall back to this cleared area, this sort of natural meadow that's called the Great Meadow. And so while he's waiting, George writes a letter to Dinwiddie to give him a report.
He writes a great letter that's actually in our collection here at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, back to Governor Dinwiddie, where he talks about the fortifications he's starting to build. And he talks about clearing brush away and making these entrenchments. And he calls this place a charming field for an encounter. Eventually, they build a stockade there, kind of a small fort. But really, it's just a palisade of logs encircling a storehouse and some earthworks. This small fort, eventually called Fort Necessity, it's within musket shot of woods and hills that surround it on almost all sides. It's really kind of an indefensible position in a lot of respects. So he's making some critical tactical errors early on, but he is certainly pleased with himself. So he is kind of essentially waiting then for an attack to come. Again, he feels like the post he has built is defensible, so he's going to try to defend it and is writing back to Dinwiddie to inform him of these matters. While Washington is writing back to Dinwiddie in this great letter, he is telling Dinwiddie about the attack at Jumonville, but not before he goes on for many paragraphs talking about disparities of pay between provincial soldiers and their fellow soldiers that are in the British payroll. So he takes some time to complain and then mentions to Dinwiddie that, by the way, this conflict has started and people have died and it's probably going to get a lot worse before it gets better. So a classic movement for a young commander in that situation.
So he asks him for a raise and some benefits, which is kind of a hard sell, given that he did just start a pretty expensive war between two major European powers. And little does Washington know, but a few days later, Colonel Joshua Fry, the actual commander of the regiment, does take an unfortunate tumble and dies. So now Washington serendipitously becomes the sole commander of his regiment. talk about failing up. But let's get back to Fort Necessity. Michael picks the story up for us.
We are at Fort Necessity. Washington does get attacked by that French force that comes out from Fort Duquesne. They surround him. He does try to march forces out initially to kind of combat those French troops and their indigenous allies in sort of traditional European battle, you know, line to line. They're not going to meet him on those terms because they can safely fire from the woods around the fort while the British soldiers huddle inside. So eventually, after a day of fighting, you know, there's rain, muskets aren't working. It's not a good situation for the Virginians. And eventually, Washington is compelled to surrender. He signs surrender documents that are written in French. They have a translator with him. His name is Jacob von Braam. Von Braam, he claims to know and be able to read and speak French. He doesn't speak English that well and is having a difficult time actually translating some of those things back to Washington. Essentially, Washington ends up signing a surrender document that he himself can't read. Remember, when he went to the French forts, he did not know French then. He still does not know French. So that does play a bit of a role in things that happen later on. But as part of that surrender document, Washington essentially is admitting that he assassinated the head of a diplomatic mission, an ensign Jumonville, who was commanding those troops that he fought. And then Washington packs his bags and is going to retreat back to Williamsburg after all is said and done. So not a good, auspicious start for Washington or the Virginians.
When Washington signs the surrender document, one that's written in French, which remember, he doesn't speak, poorly translated and soaking wet, he unknowingly admitted to the assassination of a French ambassador, which, I don't know what you guys know about international law out there, is a pretty big no-no. George Washington, just 22 years old, led an ambush that spiraled into a global war. As Horace Walpole, a member of the British Parliament during that time, later put it, a shot fired by a young Virginian in the backwoods of America set the world on fire. Okay, so now we're in the thick of it. Before we go on, though, I do want to circle back to indigenous people. We've already said that the British called this the French and Indian War because they were fighting the French and the Indians. Truth be told, some sided with the French, some with the British, and some tried to remain neutral. Their involvement would have a huge impact on how the war played out. We can see that already in the role of Tenokerson in 1754.
You can argue that the entirety of the 18th century, for the most part, was a struggle for independence for indigenous peoples. So this is one of those first instances, though, that folks are going to have to make a choice. While many indigenous nations would like to or tried to remain neutral, others had obligations and intentions that brought them to one side or the other. Eventually, most of the folks in the Eastern Woodlands, in one way or another, are involved in the French and Indian War. So they have to make a choice. And there are a number of things that influence those choices. Trade and access to trade and the quality of trade goods is a major motivating factor for Native people. The French tended to be better traders. They tended to have better trade goods. They tended to treat Native people fairly. They tended to intermarry into their families because they figured out pretty early it's easier to trade with family than strangers, right? And so that was their approach, and it was pretty successful. And that meant that many Native peoples were connected to them and were dependent on their trade and trade goods. Other folks had reasons to support the British side and throw their weight in on that side. When I think about the Haudenosaunee peoples, the Iroquois Confederacy, many years before, they had entered into this pledge of mutual support with the British called the Covenant Chain. The Covenant Chain was a pledge of mutual support between the British and the Five Nations, which later became the Six Nations of the Iroquois Confederacy. And so when things heat up with the French, the British call upon those obligations and that relationship, and most of the Iroquois folks are going to assist the British against the French and their Indian allies. In the Southeast, the Cherokee will throw themselves in with the British against the French and their Indian allies. For the Shawnee and the Delaware and some of the other folks in the Ohio country, the more immediate threat are the English.
Indigenous nations were far from passive players. They had their own interests to protect. These alliances weren't set in stone. They shifted based on trade relationships, territory, and who posed the greatest threat at the time. In 1755, the British send out a guy named General Edward Braddock and a huge force to capture Fort Duquesne and settle the score. But the British don't do so well in the wilderness.
In 1755, the following year, a major expedition is formed to march out to Fort Duquesne to capture and destroy it. It's led by General Edward Braddock. At this point in time, Washington becomes aide-de-camp, which is sort of like a support role to General Edward Braddock from the British military, and proceeds on this campaign out to Fort Duquesne. That expedition is ambushed close to the fort. Many of the troops are killed and wounded and captured. The expedition turns into a disaster. But Washington, he becomes kind of seen as this hero of what's known as the Battle of the Monongahela. Washington is able to sort of rally troops and conduct a fighting retreat to a support position where they can again continue their retreat back towards Virginia. But he's able to salvage some of those troops from that situation. He talks about the Virginians. He says famously that they behaved like men and died like soldiers. So he wants to tout these Virginians and how well they fought and how well essentially he was able to maintain order. And he's seen as someone that was in the thick of the fighting, you know, having bullet holes through his coat, horse shot out from under him, things like that. And again, is adding to this reputation of himself as a really strong leader in some of these situations. After that, Washington is appointed commander of the Virginia Regiment. He's actually the commander-in-chief of all Virginia forces at that point. And his task is to protect the borders of the Virginia colony, which stretched from the border of North Carolina all the way up to those areas that he was fighting in 1754. So he is kind of distributing his forces and trying as best he can to protect those areas. It is an impossible task, all while writing letters to the commander of the British forces in North America, petitioning to have the Virginia Regiment be part of the British military. And the letters that he writes are, they're not very nice. He's a little angry about all of these things, and he's not afraid to say it. And in some of these, he actually makes some very bold, almost revolutionary statements. He writes this letter to Governor Dinwiddie, really almost calling Dinwiddie out, saying, you don't support us. You haven't given us what we need to be successful. But also, the deck is kind of stacked against us as Virginians because we're not being held in equal esteem to these British soldiers. So Washington writes, we can't conceive that being Americans should deprive us of the benefits of British subjects, nor lessen our claim to preferment. And we are very certain that no body of regular troops ever before served three bloody campaigns without attracting royal notice. So this, we're Americans, that shouldn't deprive us of the rights of British subjects, is a pretty bold statement that he's starting to make, and really is looked back on, of course, hindsight, but looking back, thinking about this is one of those areas where Washington and some other instances where he comes up against British officers who are the same rank as him, but technically outrank him because they're British officers versus a Virginia provincial officer, he starts to kind of get this chip on his shoulder.
Somehow, despite early British losses, including Braddock's disastrous campaign, the tide eventually turns in the favor of the British. The French are exhausted with this hard-fought, costly war, and ultimately, with the Treaty of Paris in 1763, the war ends in a British victory. The war comes to an official end with the Treaty of Paris in 1763, not to be confused with the Treaty of Paris that will end the American Revolution a few years later in 1783. Honestly, could they have picked any other name for it? This Treaty of Paris is signed by Great Britain, France, and Spain, and as a result, Britain gains a massive chunk of land. And you'd think this was a win, right? But honestly, one of the most interesting things about the French and Indian War is the end, because everyone is so unhappy. With this treaty, Great Britain does get control of former French colonies in Canada, and so obviously France is upset about this. And remember, this was a global war, so Spain, who we haven't spent much time talking about, also loses out. They have to give over parts of their colony in Florida. But at least the colonists who had fought this war for expansion would be able to go westward, right? Unfortunately, not. The king is quite aware that further conflict with indigenous groups in the area after the French and Indian War is really not the correct move for the colonies. The colonies are tapped out in terms of resources, and the king wants to avoid further conflict. And so Following the Treaty of Paris, there is this royal proclamation in 1763. The crown draws a proclamation line along the Appalachian Mountains to mark the western boundary of British settlement. While colonies like Virginia still claimed land beyond the line, the administration of those territories fell to British authorities, directly clashing with the ambitions of groups like the Ohio Company and land speculators like George Washington, who were eager to profit from westward expansion.
Once the treaty is signed, the landscape is completely different. New France is no longer a thing. Britain gains control over all of that territory. Spain actually has to cede territory in what's now Florida in exchange to control or regain control of Cuba and other parts of the Spanish Empire. These are all concessions that are being made during these treaty negotiations. And all of a sudden, Britain is in control over the entirety of the eastern seaboard of North America. So it's a very different landscape, but things don't quite end there. So as part of these concessions, there is actually a proclamation line that is decreed by the King of England, and it says that those British colonies won't expand their territory beyond the crest of the Appalachian Mountains. Well, that's a big problem for a colony like Virginia, who has lands that they have just recently fought for, that people have died for, that people have essentially been promised land in for their military service, or for groups like the Ohio Company who have been granted lands by the king in those areas for their use and for their sale.
So the king shuts down westward expansion. Well, on paper, anyway. People cross the line all the time.
So the Royal Proclamation Line of 1763 is issued by the crown with the intention that it will be the definitive boundary between British American colonial settlements and indigenous peoples and their territories. The line followed the watersheds that ran along the Appalachian chain. They want to protect colonists from Indian attack, but they also want to protect indigenous peoples from further expansion by the British American colonies. So the Royal Proclamation Line effectively ends speculation in Western lands. The part that was unsuccessful was that, you know, people would cross the line anyway. It was a quote-unquote paper barrier. And even though when we talk about the coming of the American Revolution, as part of that proclamation line, the Crown left 10,000 British regular troops in the American colonies to enforce that proclamation line, keep colonists safe from indigenous attack, and also to keep colonists from going across the line. Administratively, it just didn't work out because, as General Gage at one point says, you know, we don't have the resources. We can't keep them all from streaming west, even though they're not supposed to, which is problematic because all the indigenous nations understand this arrangement.
Indigenous nations had negotiated with the crown in good faith, expecting the line to hold and protect their territories. But when settlers flooded into the borderlands, it destabilized these agreements and led to constant conflict. In Virginia's frontier especially, tensions ran high as settlers pushed further west into indigenous lands. By 1774, Virginia completely disregarded the proclamation, and during Dunmore's War, they were fighting indigenous groups and seizing land. For indigenous nations, the proclamation had offered hope for some level of protection, but its collapse reinforced the feeling that their lands and agreements were expendable. The line's failure wasn't just a colonial issue. It left a lasting impact on indigenous communities in the borderlands. When most people consider the role the French and Indian War played in teeing up the American Revolution, it's the idea of taxation that immediately springs to mind. But really, there's so much more going on. The French and Indian War was the first time we see colonies working together and forming coalitions outside of their own specific colonial identities. They all see the French as their common enemy, and they learn to work together to defeat that enemy. It is this new mindset that starts to lay the groundwork for the American Revolution. In our next episode, we will see that the British had won the war, but they're about to lose something much more important: the trust and loyalty of the American colonies. Thanks for joining us on this journey through history. I'm Maggie Creech, and this has been Revolution Revisited. Special thanks to Travis Henline and Michael Plum for sharing their expertise and insights on today's show. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe, leave a review, and share it with your friends. For more episodes and resources, including the primary sources mentioned in this episode, check out our website at virginiahistory.org/podcast.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martirana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Don't miss your chance to see Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture before it closes on January 4th. This special exhibition commemorates the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Discover Virginia's leading role in the American Revolution and how both iconic and everyday people helped forge a new nation. Tickets at virginiahistory.org.